warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
A selfie with Abu Mahdi. Abu Mahdi, the outstanding Iraqi commander, became famous for his battle with Daesh. A selfie with Abu Mahdi was made on the sidelines of the liberation of Fallujah. Using every trick in our bag and under the pretext of the liberation of Mosul, we managed to not only get to Iraq, but to Abu Mahdi. He was tired, and we knew very well that the hands of the clock move mercilessly. Abu Mahdi had less than 3 hours to get some rest until morning and before he could get back to his daily work. We considered ourselves the self-styled messengers of a nation that had to record his experience. While talking about the operations, besides getting the good news of a large-scale liberation, we got the chance to see you for a longer time, and Mosul was the last chance for us to see you very well. And now you have realized that we become more anxious by the minute and you are confiding in us. You said, "It's true that history is made with the blood of martyrs, but forgetting them moves us back for centuries." To plan for any operation, the news about the weather and precipitation is as important as the information on the geographical location of the enemy. But to go visit the fighters who guard the borders, it doesn't matter whether it's shining or raining. The presence of the highest-ranking military figure at that moment gives them more hope. In crises, we usually need a cold mind and a warm heart. This is a famous saying by a man who's been to the deserts in Kuwait, the mountains in Iran, as well as hills and rivers in Iraq. An engineer who studied politics as well later on, but remained a revolutionary until his last breath. Despite his usual smile, he never took anything lightly. How much time do you have during the day? No matter how you look at it, you shouldn't have the time to chat with the new fighters. The normal procedure is a short visit among the infantry and a few pictures and immediately a meeting with the commanders. But you have pinned your hopes on these young fighters to save Iraq. You remember their names and their homelands and pray for them. Now that the country is heading towards peace, many airplanes take off and land in Baghdad Airport. For many of them, the destination is the Green Zone, where the embassies are located. But you still prefer to be among the defenders of the city. Despite what the general public thinks, the Badr Brigades is not comprised of Iraqi prisoners of war, of those who repent their past. The Bat Brigades is the result of years of hard work by thousands of Iraqis who ventured out to confront the Ba'athist Party and Saddam. When Saddam was on the verge of fall, Abu Mahdi was the commander of the Bat Brigades. In protest against the talks with the invading U.S. forces, he resigned and, along with the Jihadi Badr group, who weren't looking for high positions in the government in return for their years-long efforts, formed and trained resistance groups against occupation forces. The Badr group and its well-trained forces formed the core of the popular mobilization forces known as Hashd al-Sha'bi in Iraq. You can see some videos time and time again, and some videos repeat time and time again. The Takfiri's rockets and bullets hit close to Abu Mahdi tens of times. His companions knew very well that nothing could fill his empty place. Because of their heartfelt respect for him, they would only react by protecting him. But the martyr knew something very well, that his life was not more important than the life of any of those youths. He firmly believed in Imam Ali's saying that fate alone can protect you. You make shelters, but you don't have any shelter yourself. A few meters in front of the front line, you're driving a loader and you are deeply thinking, when suddenly, from behind the dust-covered window of the vehicle, you see the gray hair of a man. Of course, you have to be astonished. When you get out, you will see the most popular man in Iraq. He puts his arm around your neck, and it looks like he doesn't have anything else to do but to spend some time with you. How would he forget you? I testify that you fulfill your promises. You told us about the victories even before the operations kicked off. I remember Samarra, Beji, Tikrit, Fallujah, and Mosul very well. And I believe your last promise that you said, the Euphrates isn't an oil-rich river to keep the lights on for the cowboys. Decades-long presence of the tyrants in Iraq, along with the meddling by the West, was established by triggering and taking advantage of the differences. Things like religious, race, tribe, and family backgrounds, or even issues of less importance, can bring about differences. Only a person who has moved beyond these issues can heal Iraq's centuries-old wounds. These refugees who have become homeless and have managed to save their lives from Daesh and take some of the things in their houses are mostly Sunnis. These refugees are half of the tribe who have fled hurriedly, and the other half was taken hostage by Daesh. Abu Mahdi knows very well that many of them are the families of Daesh militants, so immediately he goes there to protect them. Because he and his companions have risen up for reforms, not corruption. When Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, with his usual smile, feels he has to be angry with someone who has made a mistake, he only needs to deprive them of his smile. He postpones the operations time and time again and will not order to fire before he is assured that people are safe. A part of your mind is busy about the confrontation with the Takfiris, and another is busy thinking about accommodating and providing the refugees with services and shelter for the night and the next day. Thanks to the internet and the virtual world, Abu Mahdi's pictures and the selfies with him go viral very quickly. The families of the fighters are relieved that not only their children are safe and sound, but they are somewhere safe and away from the front lines. Because security measures never allow the commanders to go to the front lines. But they do not know that Abu Mahdi is not a commander who would command from the capital and watch the fighters from inside a bulletproof vehicle. When you got out of the fight with the Ba'athist Party and the hypocrites, we loved you with your salt and pepper hair and your coat that belonged to Badr. But your gray hair is a different story. The Haditha massacre, the Abu Ghraib victims, and thousands of children and women who were killed in Fallujah and the Mahmudiya massacre made your hair strands white one by one while you were grieving for the children of Iraq. Following up on opening the closest makeshift hospital in an operation zone for the injured and designing high embankments to stop any possible damage from suicide car bombs made the number of the martyrs less and less by the day. Al-Muhandis, or engineer, wasn't just Abu Mahdi's epithet. You and your fighters changed the geometry of a war that could change the geography of the region. It isn't something beyond imagination that after the flames of war are out, some commanders show up in political games. But you're like you were in the past, and your path is still different. You check the tracks of the front lines in the morning so the soldiers are not overjoyed with the happiness of the victory. In the afternoon, you visit the barracks of the injured soldiers who could be forgotten very quickly. It doesn't look like that you had kissed all of the martyrs in Iraq before their martyrdom. Whenever an explosion happened and the sirens of an ambulance was heard, you would get worried on behalf of everyone. You saw martyrs for 50 years, but no one's death ever became normal to you. What time in history do you remember when you hear these words? The land of Iraq. The rebels of the Levant and Iraq. The massacre of children. Beheading men and taking women hostage. Sayyid Murtaza Avni has beautifully said, "The companions of the Master of Martyrs, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, have come at the end of history to take revenge for him." War is bad, but it has a strange poetic feeling in it. We always think there is a bullet or a rocket lying in wait for us. If not me, my comrade is about to die. That's why fighters always open their arms to one another. There is no difference between news of victory, the news of a fighter's martyrdom, and the news of the arrival of a popular commander. They're just an excuse to show us what death smells like. Put yourself in a place of a militia fighter who's been fighting for 40 years. And put yourself in place of a commander who has a brave and well-prepared army. It'll be surprising if you're not strict and don't act with authority, but there's no trace of the relationship between a soldier and commander in the huge number of the fighters who are coming to you. It doesn't even look like a leader and his protégés. You're always like a father who has sent his son to the war after giving him a copy of the Quran, and now he is happy that his son is alive and well. The Iranian fighters, in contrast to the Baathists, had a famous phrase, and they would even write it on the back of their khaki shirts. Ablutions in the Euphrates and prayers in Karbala. You had told the Iranians that the slogan had come true. God willing, we'll say our prayers in the Al-Aqsa Mosque. How close you and Haj Qasim were to the slogan. Despite its several thousand-year history, Iraq was like a small child in the arms of an experienced father. The Iraq that saw nothing but destruction from the Ottomans, the Baathists, the Americans, and Daesh. And you were right when you said Daesh isn't the continuation of the Ba'ath, but the Ba'ath itself that has emerged in another form. Fighting with the devil, who was in fight with everything, was really strange. Daesh was in fight even with the past. Infidelity was an excuse to destroy the believers' graves and the shrines. Even the ancient monuments were not safe from them. They destroyed the Palmyra Museum in Syria and the Hatra ancient city and Hazarmerd in Iraq. It was you who told us that you never had the time for a trip or entertainment. With the aim of jihad, you traveled all across Iraq and visited everywhere. As you said, you went to all those places in Iraq you hadn't seen and saw them with your forces. In Abu Mahdi's lineage, we're not looking for Iranian blood, and we are not proud of him just because he speaks Farsi. But don't consider the engineer just an Iraqi. Don't consider him an Iranian either. Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis is a commander who has something to say, not only in the battlefields, but in the media. All those years, you always mentioned Haj Qasim's name, who got martyred with you many times, and God gave him back to you as a gift again. Not just as a companion brother or an eternal friend, but as a commander, and you considered yourself his soldier. He goes to the martyrs' families in the evenings. The martyr's mother is sure that Abu Mahdi has seen his son and kissed him before martyrdom. I think hard about the words, and I regret that a poet came up with these words before me. The difference between a martyr's mother and all other mothers on earth comes down to this. A martyr's mother, before becoming a martyr's mother, becomes a martyr. People in Iraq have been on the verge of victory time and again, but the last-minute differences have always ruined everything. The Iraqi Revolution in 1920 against the British, Martyr Sadr's uprising, and the Sha'ban Intifada are among them. But you're the son of your time. You changed the game of differences. You picked Hashd al-Sha'bi from among all groups, the Christians, Assyrians, Izzadis, Shias, and Sunnis. They are all with each other, and they are soldiers of the homeland. You always do your duty. In Hashd al-Sha'bi, you founded and commanded. The bitter history for forgetting Abu Zainab's and Abu Maysam's should not be repeated. When these images are broadcast by the public media, they run reminders on the screen that the video was recorded before the spread of the coronavirus, and that is the most obvious sentence after your martyrdom. Have you ever seen a world that has lost its hero? So you can see what situation we're in. Whose hand can we shake from now on? And who can we kiss? It's even better that the coronavirus is with us, and the masks have covered our pale faces. We did our job. But it was really hard to say goodbye to someone who had forgotten about the world altogether. He was tired, but we were still anxious to film him. In the end, he invited us to the recitation of the Quran with his nice voice. The verses about the status of those who had attained salvation and those were shamed, death and limbo, the hereafter and resurrection. Later on, I heard that those who recite the Al-Waqi'a Surah will be among Imam Ali's companions and followers. Commander, hero, general, all of them are beautiful words. But when it comes to homeland, you cannot find any word more beautiful than soldier. It reminds me of the line by a poet that goes, "Millions of years later, people will find the fossilized heart of a soldier and will forget it in the museums of geology." But how is it possible to forget you? But how is it possible to forget you?
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. For the septuagenarian lawmakers who wrote the historic climate bill that Congress passed on Friday, 12th of August, and the 79-year-old president who is about to sign it into law, the measure represents a once-in-a-generation victory. The article you're about to hear has been written by New York Times journalists Lisa Friedman and Coral Davenport. The piece is titled, "As Historic Climate Bill Heads to Biden's Desk, Young Activists Demand More." For the septuagenarian lawmakers who wrote the historic climate bill that Congress passed on Friday, 12th of August, and the 79-year-old president who is about to sign it into law, The measure represents a once-in-a-generation victory. But younger Democrats and climate activists crave more. They look at the bill as a down payment, and they worry a complacent electorate will believe Washington has at least solved climate change, when in fact scientists warn it has only taken the first necessary steps. This bill is not the bill that my generation deserves and needs to fully avert climate catastrophe, but it is the one that we can pass given how much power we have at this moment, said Varshini Prakash, a 29-year-old who co-founded the Sunrise Movement, a youth-led climate activism group. Cristina Zintzun Ramirez, a 40-year-old president of Next Gen America, which is focused on young voter participation, said it wasn't lost on her that the climate deal was crafted largely by older men and included some concessions to the fossil fuel industry. We are very clear that it took so long because our Congress and our Senate doesn't look like the American people, said Ms. Ramirez, whose group is working to elect more young progressives committed to attacking global warming. The climate crisis is going to unfold on the majority of young people. Most of these congressional representatives will be dead by the time we face the consequences of their actions or of their inaction. In a letter to members of Congress, Ms. Ramirez and about 50 other young leaders told lawmakers, "Your work is not finished." The House of Representatives voted 220-207 on Friday, 12th of August, to approve the Inflation Reduction Act, with Democrats pushing past united Republican opposition. It was a replay of earlier this week, when Democrats in the Senate passed the bill without a single Republican vote. The legislation provides $370 billion over a decade for investments in wind, solar, and clean hydrogen, energy storage, and other measures designed to shift the American economy away from fossil fuels that have underpinned it for more than a century. Analysts estimate that the new law will draw down the United States' carbon dioxide emissions to the lowest level since Lyndon B. Johnson was president, 20% below 2005 levels by the end of this decade, on top of another 20% cut that will come as a result of market forces already in place. Together, that would eliminate an estimated 1 billion tons of pollution per year by the end of 2030, almost enough to meet Joe Biden's pledge to cut emissions 50% by 2030. Senator Patrick Leahy, an 82-year-old Democrat of Vermont, praised the legislation when it passed the Senate as a once-in-a-generation bill to meaningfully address the real threats of climate change, a characterization echoed by several of his colleagues. But scientists are saying the United States needs to do a lot more. It must stop adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere by 2050, which the bill won't achieve. That is the target all major economies must meet to constrain average global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit above pre-industrial levels, according to scientists. Beyond that threshold, the likelihood increases significantly of catastrophic droughts, catastrophic floods, wildfires, and heat waves. The planet has already warmed an average of about 1.1 degrees Celsius. It's like losing 20 pounds when you need to lose 100 pounds, said Robert McNally, the president of Rapidan Energy Group, an energy consulting firm. Robert McNally added, "And this won't get you there." After the champagne is drunk, there will be a moment of sobriety, he said. How do you close the rest of that gap? To reach his 2030 goal, President Biden would still have to impose new regulations on emissions from power plants, vehicle tailpipes, and methane leaks from oil and gas wells. State and local governments would have to set new standards to compel the rapid adoption of electric cars, wind and solar-powered electricity, and energy-efficient buildings to make up the last percentage points. But a far heavier lift, essentially eliminating the nation's fossil fuel emissions in the next 2 decades, Congress would need to enact even more ambitious legislation than the historic bill just passed by a razor-thin majority, according to experts. To zero out emissions by 2050, Congress would have to take on politically difficult burden of taxing, penalizing, banning, or phasing out the coal, oil, and gas pollution that is driving global warming. It will be necessary for Congress to put sticks in place, said Dallas Bertrow, an energy policy expert at Resources for the Future, a nonpartisan energy and environmental research organization based in Washington, D.C. The new law buys Congress some time to act, Dallas Bertrow said. It doesn't need to happen today or tomorrow or this year or next year, he said, but it does have to happen before the end of this decade. Representative Pramila Jayapal of Washington, a 56-year-old who leads the House Progressives Caucus, said in addition to deeper cuts in emissions, young and racially diverse climate advocates want new provisions that also protect low-income neighborhoods and communities of color, which are disproportionately affected by climate impacts. They're really talking about it from this integrated perspective of jobs, justice, and decarbonization, she said. Representative Sean Caston, Democrat of Illinois and a scientist who owned a clean energy company, said Democrats and activists deserve an end zone dance after the bill is signed and then must get back to work. In the near term, Congress will have to make it easier to build the transmission lines and other facilities needed to allow the explosion of solar, wind, and other renewable energy promised by the new law, he said. Sean Caston, a 50-year-old, also wants Congress to eliminate tax breaks and other subsidies granted to the oil, gas, and coal industries, a move, he said, will trigger markets to correctly allocate capital to clean energy industries. We have to be, as legislators, very clear-eyed that we are not going to be judged on whether we voted yes or no on this bill, he said. We're going to be judged on whether the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is lower or higher 10 years from now. Even as scientific evidence links climate change to extreme weather events that is causing death and destruction in the United States, opinion polls show that the American electorate is divided along partisan lines about the scale of the problem and what to do about it. A Pew survey published in July found a majority of Republicans and independents who lean Republican, about 82%, say Joe Biden's climate policies are hurting the country, while 79% of Democrats and those who lean to the left were broadly supportive of Biden's policies. But Republicans between the ages of 18 and 29 surveyed were more likely than older adults to say the federal government needs to act on climate change, and 64% wanted the government to require power companies to use more energy from renewable sources. And younger Americans of both political parties, those born after 1981, are more likely to be politically engaged on climate change than older generations, according to a 2021 Pew survey. Celinda Lake, a Democratic strategist, said she believes the political support for a carbon tax could grow, particularly as Millennial and Generation Z voters entered office. In 2024, the Millennials and younger generations will outnumber the Boomer voters, Celinda Lake said. She added, "These are the voters who vote on this issue. It mobilizes them. In the next 20 years, we will see a massive shift in the electorate towards people who want to save the planet." Wisconsin State Representative Greta Neubauer, a 30-year-old, led the rollout of a package of 22 climate bills this year, five of which she wrote. None received a hearing in the Republican-led legislature, much less a vote. But Ms. Neubauer says she still finds the number of former activists like herself now turning to politics encouraging. "When Donald Trump was elected, we all had to look around and recognize the failures of our movement," said Ms. Neubauer, who ran on a climate platform and was elected in 2017. Many of her fellow former activists have recently joined political campaigns or considered running for office themselves to take the fight off college campuses, she said. William Riley, who served as head of Environmental Protection Agency under President George H.W. Bush, said Democrats will be lucky to just maintain the new provisions that just barely got through the Congress. "As long as you've got a unanimous Republican position against it, they're going to have to fight just to keep what they've got in place," William Riley said. "They have to fight to keep the clean energy incentives, fight to keep any regulations, and Republicans will try to claw it back unless at some point enough Republicans feel that they are politically free to convert." Benji Becker, a 24-year-old founder of American Conservation Coalition, a conservative climate action group, said if Republicans retake either the House or Senate in November's midterm elections, he wants party leaders to address climate change. He noted that climate and tax bill includes incentives for nuclear power and other Republican priorities, including carbon capture technology that could allow coal or gas-burning power plants to keep operating with lower carbon emissions. Republicans can either go after that in the next Congress and champion the first-ever bipartisan climate bill, or they can stay where they've been for the last decade, Mr. Becker said. "My generation will be disappointed if they don't lead from the front." Rihanna Gunn-Wright, a 32-year-old director of climate policy at the Roosevelt Institute, a liberal think tank and an architect of the Green New Deal, said she is worried a sense of complacency will settle in after passage of this climate bill. "Over the next 7 or 8 years, there will still, unfortunately, be extreme weather events, and we'll still need to keep pointing out the cause of those events, carbon dioxide emissions. And from where? From fossil fuels," she said. Ms. Gunn-Wright said she knows activists who fought for decades to see a president sign major climate legislation will be tired. But she cautioned, "In the United States, we have a history of taking a lot of first steps and then not taking the second step, the third, or the fourth step."
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Back to Reality. In the studio with me, I have the honor of hosting two special guests. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, gentlemen. Thank you so very much for joining us.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much for having us.
How do you do?
I'm good, thank you.
And Sayyid Abdullah, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
The honor and pleasure is all mine. I personally think we can spend the entire year talking about Arba'in and the Mashaya and the whole walk that people have been doing this past few years. Somewhere around like 25, 30 million people gather in Iraq in order to visit Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, who is literally the center of the universe. But now is the best time as ever to highlight it more. And
people have already started walking there, right?
Beautiful, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's such a, as spiritual as it is, obviously, it's also such a physical trial, isn't it?
Yeah, it's physically quite difficult.
I think it's even more testing than Hajj.
I think that what makes Arba'in Arba'in.
Exactly.
You know what?
So
if it was Arba'in without these things, it wouldn't be Arba'in. I think one of the ulama I was listening to recently, he said, well, you know, what have you done for Imam Hussein? He's like, even when you come to cry and you come to the majalis, you're actually enjoying it.
True. Nothing you're selfless about
exactly.
it.
Exactly. So what have you given back? Even the majalis itself, it's an enjoyment. When you go home, you go feeling happy and relaxed
elated,
and energized.
Yeah.
I feel people miss out on the spirituality in Hajj.
Mm.
And this is also why I feel in Arba'in we also get that spirituality. This material luxury is not there to stop us from benefiting from the spirituality, is not there to distract us from that, right? And this is what makes Arba'in Arba'in, exactly like you're saying, that because it's so simple, because there's so much difficulty, you're able to connect better. You keep reminding yourself that, look, this, I'm going through this for Allah, for the love of Imam Hussein. And I think this helps us to keep that connection, right? Whereas in Hajj, unfortunately, a lot of people get carried away with those material luxuries and they lose that focus.
And mind you, that's deliberate, huh? I'm 100%. No.
This
is not a laughing matter. This is like, it's been going for at least 15, 20 years now. They said, we want to make Hajj such a luxury that it deprived people of their
feels more like a
spirituality. You know, like
right?
Even, you know how they build the tower, the clock towers. They said that when you walk in the holy mosque itself, your eyes first will go where? To the clock tower. It's how massive and huge it is that you forget to look at the Kaaba itself. Which, looking at the Kaaba as ibadah. So they try to make it as luxurious as possible, so
to
deprive people of their spirituality and their iman, and becomes just rituals.
Yeah.
And now, I'm not sure if had this happened to you or not, but in Hajj, where actually people start to argue about their food and fight about their sleep and fight about their rooms, I'm like...
Because they feel so entitled at this
exactly.
point.
Exactly. Yeah. Where, for example, if you come back to Karbala, people don't fight with each other. They don't complain.
They're begging you to come.
Yeah, they actually. They do like amazing things. Like they would offer in some areas, they would offer like crazy things just to get you to come. Like they'll give you new clothes, we'll give you SIM card, we'll charge you credit for you. Just come. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So they would go just to do whatever they want to satisfy and make the pilgrims happy in Arba'in. And I think this is also one of my concerns as well, that there are a lot of hands at play that want to deprive people of the spirituality of Arba'in and make it more of a luxury trip. Mm-hmm. So I'm walking to Imam Hussein, like Brother Asa said, but I want to make sure that I sleep in the best of tents, in the best of mawakib.
You're listening to Back to Reality. We're going to be back to reality after a short break, so don't go anywhere.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Brother Yasser, statistically speaking, how many people go on Hajj each year? 2-3 million, right?
I've heard up to 3 million.
Back in the day, you used to reach 50.
There's no way to accommodate to the people of Arba'in like they do.
No, so
for
I
Hajj.
I think there is, but I think it's natural for people to slowly start bringing luxury.
I
think it's a natural human thing. So, for example, I'll tell you about my own community. For example, once in our community, somebody on Ashura day, not on Ashura day, on the Shahada of the Prophet, cooked some really good food.
Right.
And his intention was literally that for the sake of the Prophet, I'm going to cook this really nice biryani or something.
Out of absolute devotion.
Now, some people went like, what's wrong with you? You know, it's the Prophet's Shahada. Why are you cooking so good food? He's like, I want to give this to the people for the Prophet's sake. And they're like, no, this is disrespectful.
Oh,
the
we're
Prophet.
Mourning. Why are you
exactly,
like,
we're mourning.
Being all
this
extra
is why I think. I think that the Iraqi people, at least those who are well off, would be like, you know what? I have the money. Why should I not provide the best service I can to those
people? No, we're saying provide the best service you can to people, but then make sure you don't give people the impression that you know, it's just about their pleasures and desires.
So that's where the personal perspective comes.
Because
I've
noticed this trend in the last few years of Arba'een where people start to complain a lot. People wanting more of this and more of that. And why is this? Why is that? I'm like, you're defeating the purpose of the walk. You know, so make sure that
I think that's a personal thing, right? So I, as the Zair, I have the duty to not ask for more. But the guy who's serving, he wants to give more, right? And this is where his duty is to try and provide the best he can, which in someone's case might be a really nice sofa and, I don't know, air conditioner and all that. But me as the Zair, my perspective is that, you know what, if I don't get that and I get something else, I should be satisfied and happy.
Right? So I think
the perspectives need to be...
Yeah, I think that the Atab al-Husayni or Abbasi, you know, they had this Madinat al-Zairin on the way. Where it is like a 5-star accommodation for Zuwar in every sense of the word. And now people kill themselves to get into it. And obviously they only can take a number of amount of people and only people they choose, like what, I don't know, VIP walkers, right? Which is, I mean, it became like, you have a special mawaki for a special authenticities. Like, if you're from this country, this is for you. No one allowed in it.
I like the idea.
Yeah, but then you see there's a lot of things, you know, a lot of, for the fraction decided to happen. So I think we have, like I said, I'm just afraid, inshallah, this won't happen, that inshallah. We won't turn into that kind of aspect where people, their mentality
obviously
shifts.
There's going to be a lot of drama because there's like 25, 30 people, different backgrounds, different ethnicities from all walks of life. You know, there's going to be a lot of controversy and drama and problems.
And you get people who are not necessarily the best of people, right?
Exactly.
People come for the love of Imam Hussein.
See, that's
doesn't
the thing,
mean that they've
it?
Come completely like self-purified and, you know, they've got the best of akhlaq. They're going to come with their own faults. And, you know, some people, because of the love for comfort they have, and some people generally can't sleep, for example, if they don't have a good pillow, right? This is how they've lived, right? So they'll be looking for that comfort, right? Some people, for example, need their chai. Right, you know, you get people from different walks of life with different bad habits and good habits. So you're gonna have frictions. You're gonna have, you know, people being lured here and there. It's the Zaire's own journey whilst he's doing that physical journey towards Imam Hussein to do the spiritual journey towards Imam Hussein and moving from what he is right now to becoming something more like Imam Hussein.
Exactly, and because Imam al-Hussein, salawatullah salamu alayhi, he is Safinat al-Najat. He's the ark of salvation. I truly believe in my heart of heart that he will provide for that Zaire who came to him with the intention of expressing his love and devotion to the Imam. He will provide that necessary growth, even if it takes that Zaire 10 more trips to Karbala.
Inshallah. We shouldn't fall in the trap and think that just by coming there, things happen by magic. There has to be a certain effort from our side
absolutely,
as well.
Absolutely.
We should have the intention to change at least. And when we try, it's like that famous hadith, right? If you take one step towards Allah, he takes 10 steps towards you, right?
Beautiful.
It's the same concept. If we try at least, then we'll get the help. But if it's like, you know, you want water from the rain, but you keep your cup upside down, well, you're never going to catch any water, right? You need to first turn your cup, okay, the right way around, and then you'll start getting the water from the rain according to your own capacity.
It's so important.
So yeah, we need to put a bit of effort in that, a bit of attention, get a bit of ma'rifah. You know, the more ma'rifah you have, the walk will make more sense.
Yeah.
You'll be able to benefit much more from the walk, from the people around, from the different ziyarat and activities and the dhikr along the way and so on.
And that's what you said was also interesting. Brother Yasser, and also you, Sayyid, you were saying that we end up doing things that defeat the purpose of Arba'een. Just like Brother Yasser said, that people that go on the Hajj pilgrimage, which is one of the most sacred and I think symbolically profound aspects of Islam, right? And in a lot of our narrations, every time Rasulullah Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam wants to compare the reward of something, like he wants to say that things reward is like so much. He compares it to Hajj.
To Hajj, exactly.
Because it's the one of the most significant pillars of our religion. And unfortunately, they've distorted it so much and they've turned it into some sort of luxury destination vacay spot, right? what do you think is the objective of Arba'in so that we can better understand the things that would defeat that? Like, I personally, off the top of my head, I think one of the most profound aspects of Arba'in is selflessness. You're selfless as a za'ir, where you're not like my chai, my bed, my food, my your service.
So even
selfless, I mean, as a host.
Even when we talk about selflessness, you're still making it personal, which is selfish. So what you're trying to gain from Arba'in is something that will benefit you on a personal level.
No, so no. I'm asking what is the purpose. What? Yeah,
look,
of course, we do everything.
Look, the purpose of Arba'in, purpose of Arba'in, beside having to, like, even when you talk about your spiritual needs, like, I want to be this, I want to be that, that's also a form of selfishness itself.
Okay, okay.
The whole purpose of Arba'in is to actually understand the mission of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and why did he did what he did.
That's beautiful.
And how can I and you carry that message? That's the whole idea. If we're walking and we actually don't understand that and we don't apply that in our lives and we don't take it to the next generation, then we're literally wasting our time. You know, yeah, they say Imam Hussein, he rose against oppression. Yeah, but what is oppression? Imam Hussein wanted to seek freedom for people. Yeah, but what is freedom? These concepts that the Imam Hussein rose against, people don't understand. You know, for example, when you live in a system that is like what we call Tawuti system or system, oppressive system.
Tyrannical.
You know, I was listening to this late Shaykh, may Allah bless his soul. He said Yazid, compared to the tyrants of today,
he's nothing.
You know what I mean? We have system who are Tawuti, who are, and sometimes I find myself in that system supporting it, helping it and nurturing it. Now, if I compare myself to Imam Hussein's time, where do I put myself? The people of Kufa, Suyufuna alayk wa qulubuna ma'aka, or swords against your hearts with you? Or no, if we look at our lives, I will say to you, 99% of us will find ourselves in Yazid camp and not in Imam Hussein's
crying
camp. And
for
do you know
Hussein.
Why? Because we never understood the message of Imam Hussein correctly. And this is the aim. You know, when Imam Hussein, you know, even, you know how you began, why do people go to Imam Hussein alayhi salam? Why Imam Hussein and not other imams?
Because he's the center of the universe.
Yeah, but why is he the center of the universe? This is where, you know, when we talk about Sifatullah, Jalaliyah, wa Jamaliyah, Imam Hussein comes in the middle. But we'll leave that for another day.
Yes, don't take it.
So the idea is here is that unless we understand why we're walking to Imam Hussein, what we take is going like, you know, it's like he's going to an ocean to drink water, but you come back with nothing. You know what I mean? It's like you won't get much unless we understand the idea of Ahl Bayt constantly emphasizing Imam Hussein. Every occasion, do ziyar to Imam Hussein. Every this Imam Hussein. And everything Imam Hussein is there. Because they hoping that one day it will click in your head. What is Imam Hussein's message? How can I learn from it? How can I actually see it? Not just have it theoretical that he rose up and he wanted to seek justice for mankind. Blah, blah, blah. And then what? There has to be. So I think this walk, if we do not actually harvest it in that way of knowing what Imam Hussein alayhi salam is all about, then it's not going to do us as good as we thought.
There's so much more to talk about regarding this topic, obviously. And that's all the time we have for today. So thank you so very much for being with us. Until another episode of Back to Reality, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the ummah rise again let us see daylight again once again.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.